It's time for me to come to your homes again. Phil Parr here. And our show is called, as usual, every week. We call it Blind Like Me. Why we chose that title, I don't know. But it seemed appropriate at the time, and I guess it still is. Because I am totally blind. And Ken Meyer is on the phone with us from Boston.
Yes, sir.
Is that right? And you're also totally blind.
Right.
So I suppose blind like me would be quite apropos. Well, it's good to meet you. You're another graduate from Batavia School for the Blind.
That's right. Graduated in 1967.
Well, our friend, your mutual friend, Tim Hendel, has been furnishing us with guests lately from Batavia, things that people that he thinks we would like to interview, and I don't mean to put him down for that. We appreciate his help. We need it, all the help we can get with anything we do. And Tim has become a good friend of this show, and we appreciate Tim. Now, if you don't mind me asking, sir, what age are you?
I'm 58 years old at the moment.
58 at the moment. Well,
soon to be 59 in the middle of August.
That is a good age. I remember it well.
Yes, I'm sure.
Been a few years ago, but I remember it well. Now, your vision is zero now. Did you begin life with no vision at all?
Yes, I was born 2 months premature and had retrolateral fibroplasia, which was detached retina, and also caused by too much oxidation. And it turned out that a lot of people that I went to school with at that time had the same problem. They eventually got it solved.
Yeah.
But too late to do me any good. So that's what caused the loss of sight.
If they hadn't put you in the incubator with the oxygen, you wouldn't have lived.
Well, yeah, that's another way of looking at it.
They did, and by doing that, they cost you your eyesight. And this is, we have interviewed many people who had the same condition that you had, and of course living without eyesight is, as you and I both know, is a inconvenience. It's not a handicap, it's just a hell of an inconvenience.
That's true.
But it could be done. And you were born and raised in Boston? You've always been in Boston or not?
No, I was born and raised in upstate New York. I'm originally from Rochester, New York.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm originally from Rochester, New York, and attended the Batavia School for the Blind, and then came to Boston.
Then came to Boston. But now Batavia must have been one of the better schools for the blind, because most of the people that I've talked to from there seem to have had a pretty good time at Batavia.
I did. I had a wonderful time at Batavia. I enjoyed every bit of it. I usually go to our alumni reunions that we have every year. I was vice president of our alumni association for 2 years and president of the association for 8. Some of the best friends I have in the world are from Batavia, mm-hmm. and I wouldn't have traded 1 minute of it. It's funny you mentioned Tim, because we were talking yesterday. When I was in school, one of the things that we did every year, there were 6 schools for the blind all over the Eastern Seaboard.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I can remember them all, but there was Batavia, Boston, the Philadelphia School, the Overbrook School for the Blind in Philadelphia, Baltimore, New York Institute, and there's one more. I want to say Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
But we all got together every year for a music festival. We would all learn the same pieces. And I got to tell you, hearing a chorus of ours of maybe like 30 people doing it is one thing, but getting together with 5 other schools and maybe making it a couple of hundred doing it is an experience that I'll always remember the rest of my life. And the ironic thing about that is that the first year that I went was in 1962, and it was here in Boston. at the Perkins School for the Blind. And I never, at that time, in a million years, ever figured that I would be back in Boston working, let alone owning a home in this city.
Actually living in Boston. Tim, my blind school experience was not good. I did not have a good time. I was not happy there. He fusses at me all the time because I complained about blind schools, and and they're not, you know, they're, obviously they weren't all alike. I mean, I understand that. Mine was very bad, but everybody I've talked to from there seems to have had a pretty good time. So they must have had some people there who actually cared about blind folks.
Oh, absolutely. Our teachers, the word dedication was in their vocabulary, and overtime was not. I mean, I was a member of our high school orchestra. I played the bass clarinet and was in the high school orchestra for 5 years. We had a teacher that was there at 8 in the morning, and on Wednesday nights, we didn't get out of orchestra rehearsal until 10 o'clock or 10:30 sometimes.
Really?
And he spent time with us. We went on trips all over. New York State and played at different schools. Our chorus played at different schools, and it was a great association, and they always taught us that we were just as good, if not better, than any sighted students.
Yeah, but in your early years, they began teaching you. I think even if you heard him or not, I had John German on last week.
I heard about it.
And John was telling me about the different kinds of Braille. Did they start teaching you just grade one Braille like they did the rest of us, or how did that work?
Oh, boy, you're asking me to remember 50 years ago.
Well, yeah, that's the deal here, Ken.
As I remember it, it was just learning the Braille on the regular Braille on little flashcards and also using... Braille pegboards. Boy, I haven't seen those in years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my earliest memory of learning Braille. I never learned New York Point or anything like that. I've heard of it, but I don't know it. I never learned it. I just learned the basic Braille system. We started in kindergarten, and we learned each letter, and then we learned the different words, and they'd show them to us on flashcards, and
mm-hmm.
the rest, as they say, is history.
Well, of course, you know Tim much better than I do, but he is the kind of person who would delve into things, and I think he's going to come on in a couple of weeks and tell us, since we brought up New York Point Braille, he's going to tell us all about how it works, and brother, he'll know, won't he?
Oh, listen, if anybody will know, he will.
He'll know.
No question about that. I think he helped Thomas Edison invent the cylinder record before he was born.
Well, he wants to talk about those, too.
I'm sure he does.
He's got some information that he feels that John didn't quite get across clear enough to our listeners, and he wants to come back on and tell us about that. So we're going to do that a little bit later on. So happy childhood, good high school. Play French horn?
I played the bass clarinet. Childhood,
mm-hmm.
I had a very good one. My parents weren't rich by any means, let's put it that way, but we weren't poor. Anything I wanted, I was able to get. I had great parents. They supported me right from the very beginning. They came up to the school for any event that I was in, even if my father wasn't interested in the orchestra playing something from an opera or something like that.
They would come,
up.
Yeah.
And I was always grateful to my parents for that. They were just, I always thought they were of course I'm prejudiced, but
yeah.
I think they were the best parents anybody could have had. They supported me as far as getting into radio was concerned. You know, as my dad said, I mean, my dad was a cabinet maker. And he said to me, boy, you know, if I could help in any way I would, because I want you to get someplace, but I can't. And that's a whole other story. But they didn't tell me, don't go for it. If this is what you want, you know,
do it.
You have our blessing,
yeah.
And good luck, and we'll do anything we can. And they, you know, they did. They were just very supportive. They were never negative. I had all the love that anybody could have wanted. I wish I could do it all over again.
Well, we have now alluded to you getting into radio. That interest blossomed early, I suppose, as it does in many of us blind people.
Oh, heavens. I liked radio ever since I was 7 or 8 years old. I all facets of it. Luckily, radio, old-time radio, was still around when I was growing up, because I was born in 1946 and got, you know, started listening to stuff in the early 50s, like maybe, 51, 52. And so I was still on the fringes of it, and I just loved it. I enjoyed listening to the radio dramas. My mother used to tape record soap operas for me. Believe it or not, when I was in school, she'd tape The Romance of Helen Trent and Argyle Sunday every day. So that
really?
When I came home, I could listen to it on a weekend, because Batavia was a residential school, as are many of the schools for the blind. So when I came home on a weekend, I had that to listen to, and I was just always fascinated with it. My parents gave me a tape recorder when I was 10 years old in 1956, and I still remember the fun I used to have, you know, pretending that I was a radio announcer and talking into a microphone and doing miniature radio programs. I was just in love with radio and a microphone. And in the third grade, we got a chance to go to a radio station up in Rochester, which is where I'm originally from.
Uh-huh.
It was WHAM radio up there, which is 50,000 watts, which is comparable to WBZ is here.
Yeah.
I don't know what station in Texas you could compare it to, but it was one of the powerhouse stations and still is. And I remember I stood in back of an announcer, I'll never forget it, his name was Ross Weller, and he did a station break. And even at that time, I thought to myself, wow, what a great thrill that would be to be able to do that.
Wow.
And that was only in the third grade.
This is WHAM Rochester.
Exactly.
In big, deep
1180 on your dial.
1180 in Rochester. Big, deep voiced all the time and very carefully announcing words.
Absolutely.
What a thrill for a third grader. I envy you. That's wonderful.
I enjoyed it very much. And, you know, everybody used to say to me, my God, how can you go on the air and sit in front of a microphone?
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I was grateful for in Batavia was that we used to have speech assemblies in the like eighth, ninth grades, and we had to give talks to people of that era and higher grades and things like that. And we also had to do it every week in our history class. We used to get a magazine called Current Events, and we had to pick an article and read it and give a talk on it. And so for me, talking in front of an audience became no problem. When we had field trips or when we had programs at the school, I was always a master of ceremonies because everybody knew I was a big ham and had no problem being in front of a microphone. So when I got a chance to go on the air, whether it be in college or at WBZ, sitting in front of a microphone and doing that was a breeze, except that the audience was unseen. But I had absolutely no problem with it.
And your mother, you say, would tape these soap operas during the week, and on the weekend you would spend Saturday afternoon listening to The Adventures of Helen Trent.
That's right. The Romance
That's so
of Helen
funny.
Trent and Our Gal Sunday.
That is so funny, because I remember all those so well. My mother would be ironing. At that time, all women, housewives, women that stayed home, ironed.
Right, exactly.
My mother, I spent more time standing there with that sprinkling bottle ironing than...
Well, the ironic thing was I never in my life ever dreamed that I would get to know Helen Trent and Our Gal Sunday later on in my life.
And you probably interviewed both of them.
I did, and
yeah.
Was very close friends with Julie Stevens, who was Helen Trent.
Of course, at this time, there was a problem with blind people and radio in that there was a lot of live copy read back then. And
yeah,
but
I didn't even think about that at the time. The problem at the time when I was in Batavia was just trying to get into college where I could basically learn the mechanics of radio, how to run a board, how to cue up a record. Anybody remember records?
I have thousands
and how to play cartridges and how to put a commercial that was on a reel of tape onto a cartridge. And at that time, the Vocational Rehabilitation Service in Rochester, God knows what it is now, but that's what it is in the 60s, didn't want me to do it because they figured blind people couldn't make it in radio broadcasting.
I know.
And they said, okay, you have to find somebody that is successful. And I did, through a gentleman named Lauren Pelkey, who was our piano technology teacher at the time. He casually mentioned it to a friend of his on shortwave that this is what we were looking for. And he knew of a guy named Ed Walker in Washington, D.C., who was working at WRC Radio, which was the NBC O&O station at that time, owned and operated by NBC.
Mm-hmm.
So through this gentleman that my friend Lauren Pelkey knew at Batavia, we set up a phone patch one day, and I talked to Ed Walker via shortwave and asked him a bunch of questions, which he answered. And that became very helpful to me in getting the Vocational Rehabilitation Service to agree to sponsor me as far as going to college was concerned. And then I had to find a place to go.
Wait a minute. Let's back up a little bit. They said that they would not fund you or help you do this unless you could find some blind person who was successfully doing it.
Exactly.
Because in their mind, it couldn't be done.
Exactly.
They'd never seen anybody do it. They didn't know anything about radio, and they just assumed this is something a blind person can't do.
Exactly.
The typical attitude of a state rehabilitation service in that time.
Yeah, it changed later on, obviously.
Oh, it changed. It's changed greatly now.
but
you found this guy in Washington,
yep.
and you talked with him,
yep.
and he answered some questions, and so the next time you saw your counselor or your person who represented the state, you said, all right, here's a guy. You want his phone number? We'll talk with him. He's doing it.
I did better than that. I typed up a transcript of the conversation and gave it to him.
Really?
Yep.
So then she couldn't say no. All right. I tell you what let's do. Let's take we take two little breaks here, and let's take the first one, and then we want to come back and talk about your days in school, because you did this with Braille. There were no computers then. You did this all with slate and stylus or Braille writer. There was no other way for you to take notes or do anything except with Braille. Back in just a minute with more of our show called Blind Like Me. Hang on. Be right back. The whole point of the Blind Handyman Show is blind people have as many plumbing problems and household repairs to do as sighted people do, but we can't do them exactly the same way sighted people do, so we need some input from other blind people to find out how they do household repairs, and so we started this Blind Handyman, and we got a list going. And as far as Blind Like Me is concerned, we want to use it as an educational tool. As I remember being a young person and thinking, well, how am I going to, I want a nice house and as kids and a good job, but how am I going to do that? And I had just had no idea. I think the Blind Like Me Show demonstrates the fact that it can be done even if you are blind. That's not a handicap. It can be done.
If you would like to be a guest on either show, or you can suggest someone as a guest, email us at blindhandyman@hotmail.com or blindlikeme@txucom.net.
Well, so far, it's been a labor of love. Blind Sites. Here's a website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Sites, here's Tim Cummings.
I was listening to the radio this morning and just heard a story about retail and about how a lot of big department stores are now going to be having less service people to help you, which can be a difficult thing for us blind people going in and looking for something. Well, one of the stores that I need to use but I can't frequent because there's not one near me is JCPenney. And I have found that JCPenney's website is very accessible. I just bought some socks, as a matter of fact, recently from there. And sometimes it's difficult buying clothes as a blind person because some of the sites you're not sure what the colors are and you're not sure about the sizes. But I've had no problem with JCPenney in terms of finding the size. And they describe, or at least tell you, what the different colors of an item are that you can pick from. It's very accessible. I'd give it a screen reader friendliness rating of a 9. The website is www.jcpenney.com. For Blind Sites, this is Tim Cummings saying, keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sights. Our guest is Ken Meyer. I'm Phil Parr, and it's good to have you all with us. So many blind people fall in love, as we did, with radio, and so very few are able to actually find gainful employment or get on the air and are able to... I gather that you eventually were able to actually make a living.
Very much so.
Yeah.
I made a living both as a producer and a talk show host.
Yes, well, there are lots of interest, but very few people who are able to do that. You're one of the fortunate, one of the very few, or maybe not fortunate or any of those things, but persistent, because that's what it took to get there. I know what it took. I got there.
Now, you're right.
Let's go to college with you. This was a 4-year degree that you were going to get in communications?
Two years.
Little 2-year college.
Yep. Graham Junior College in Boston, Massachusetts.
They had a little FM on at that time.
They had a carrier current station.
Okay.
Which, if you were lucky, you could hear it out in the lobby of the station if you stood in front of the speaker.
I know exactly what you need.
It really didn't go very far. If you were lucky, maybe on a good day you could pick it up in the dormitory where we were.
Well, if it didn't go through a transformer.
But I was lucky enough to get a spot. As a matter of fact, the first time I auditioned, I failed. I tried out as a rock and roll DJ, and I failed miserably. I mean, it was terrible. But then they were doing a program called Calendar, which was a magazine feature every day from 9 to 10 o'clock in the morning. And sports is something I've always been interested in and had a passion for. So I went to them and said, look, what if I tape a sports commentary on something every day that maybe runs 3 or 4 minutes and you guys can run this? And they said, okay, do it. So I did. And then I got involved doing a sports talk show at night with another gentleman who worked at the station. And so that was how I got on the air at Graham Junior College.
Hmm. But they didn't like you as a rock and roll disc jockey.
I didn't either, and I hope the tape has been mercifully destroyed, because if I ever find a copy of it, I'll do it myself.
Well, I would love to hear that. I've got tapes in Texas City, my first radio job. I don't know why they kept me. I've no idea why I was so bad.
I'm glad they gave me another chance, because it was a lot of fun. I had an instructor there that was one of the greatest guys in the world. I would have never made it without him. Because you have to keep in mind that Batavia was a residential school. I left there to come to Boston.
Hmm.
I was 400 miles away from home. I didn't know anybody. I didn't know the campus. Everybody was sighted. You know, when you go to a school for the blind, you are the rule rather than the exception. When you go to a college, it's completely the opposite. You're the exception rather than the rule. And I was so discouraged the first week. I'd go back to my dorm room and I'd think to myself, what in God's name ever made me think that I could get into radio? Why did I ever decide to do this? And then I had a guy named Dick Walsh who taught a course called Radio One. And I met him on a Tuesday afternoon. He sat there and talked to us for an hour, and there was just something about him and his demeanor that just changed my whole outlook. And I decided, geez, maybe I can lick this thing. And I was able to, and it was because of his constant tutoring and pep talks and all kinds of stuff that was able to help me do it.
I really like the way you put that, that at the blind school you are the rule, and when you get into college you are the exception rather than the rule.
Because they didn't have the technology that you have today. They didn't have a Braille and speak, or they didn't have the Braille note or anything like that to help you with notes. And the first time I ever tried to use a Braille writer in a class, I thought I was going to get thrown out. And, oh, no, you can't do that here. That's too noisy. And I said, yeah, but I used to be in classes where we had, you know, 10 or 12 of us all banging on these things to take notes. And, well, that may be, but you can't do that here. So I had to either tape the class and then go back and listen to it, which was boring, or find somebody that had taken pretty good notes, or I had to remember stuff and write it down. And that was basically, I used a combination of all three. And plus having some of the books on tape, which had been read by volunteers from National Braille Press here in Boston, because we were able to get the books, a list of the books ahead of time, and get them purchased and get them sent to National Braille Press, and they recorded many of them. So, and I had volunteer readers as well. So, I made it. When I look back at it now, I wonder how I did it. It would have been a lot easier, I think, today with all the things that are available. And you know, all the technology and the way to get books and the way books are produced now and all that kind of stuff. But it was very, very difficult back then.
Well, that is the point at which many blind people stall in their lives, when they come from that blind school where they are the rule, where there's all blind people, and then they're dumped into a sighted world. So we talk every week that this comes up, whether you're better off going to a blind school or whether you're better off being mainstreamed and having sighted kids around you. Some kids are successful at that and some are not, and that's not what we want to talk about today, but it is a... It is still an interesting subject that
will... I'm sure it is, but from what little I know about it, I think many of these places de-emphasize Braille. I mean, I remember talking to a young man once who wanted to get into broadcasting, and he didn't know too much Braille. He knew how to run a computer, but he didn't know too much Braille. And I said, well, how are you going to be able to tell the time on the air? You know, how are you going to be able to find a cartridge? You know, if you want to tell the time, what are you going to do? Check a computer and then tell the audience what the time is? Or how are you going to read a commercial if you don't know Braille?
Yeah, gee, I never thought of that.
Well, you got to know a little Braille at least to label the carts.
Exactly.
You've got to be able to label those. You've got to be able to at least label the jingles, and of course they don't. Nothing's. We're dinosaurs. They don't do things like that. Nobody. I've got a 3-stack and a cart recorder sitting in my storeroom, and they've been in there for about 7 years, and a whole sack of carts that I'd give anybody who wanted them. They just we don't use those anymore. That's
well, yeah, that's the thing too. And a lot of times now, what's happening is radio stations are using touch screens.
Yeah,
which I have not tried to run, but I would venture to say are more difficult than taking a cartridge, putting it in a cartridge machine, and pushing the buttons.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, they have producers now that will do that kind of thing for even sighted talk show hosts. So it kind of works itself out.
Now, okay, you got this 2-year degree, and it was a little degree in they called it a degree in communications, right?
Associate AAS, Associate. Yeah, something like that, I guess. I'm not sure exactly what it was.
Okay.
Associate Science or something of that degree, but it was in communications, yes.
And so then you had to find a job.
Yep,
it was time to take that degree and actually parlay it into something that Ken Meyer, had to make a living.
Yep, exactly.
What did you do? What did you do?
Well, I looked around all over New York State, and I couldn't find anything. I went to WHIM, where I'd given anything to work. And the program director, who was a good friend of mine and helped me find the college to go to, as a matter of fact, told me, he said, Kenny, I can't do anything for you. He said, I just can't. I can't help you. And so...
That's discouraging.
Yeah, it was very discouraging. It was very disheartening, because I would have loved nothing better at that time than to be able to live in my own hometown and be on the air and stay at home. And
of course, well, now most people who are starting in radio don't start out at a 50-kilowatt radio station.
No, they don't. It's the old saying of being in the right place at the right time, and that is exactly what happened to me. I couldn't get a job anywhere. In fact, I was told by one guy at a small radio station somewhere in New York State, you know, if you were black and had no experience, you'd be perfect. I'd find a spot.
Have to.
But I called my pal Dick Walsh at Graham College, and he gave me a big pep talk over the phone and said, look, there's no reason. I still think you can do this stuff. Why don't you come up with your parents and let's see what we can do? Excuse me.
Yeah.
So I said, okay. So my parents and I came to Boston. Dick Walsh contacted the president of the school, Milton Graham. That's why it was called Graham Junior College.
That's just good.
And he contacted a gentleman named Lamont Thompson, who was on the board of trustees at Graham, and who also was an area vice president for Westinghouse Broadcasting, who owned WBZ Radio at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So... they arranged for me to go over and meet Lamont Thompson, and I interviewed with him, and then he took me downstairs to meet the program director, a gentleman named Bill Schubert. Now, it turned out that Bill Schubert used to work with my pal Dick Walsh at Graham College. They used to work together at the CBS radio station here in Boston at the time. So he called Dick Walsh on the telephone. They talked for half an hour, And he put down the phone. He said, "Kenny, I've never heard anybody praised so much in my entire life. If he says you can, if you can do half the stuff that Dick Walsh says you can, you know, you could replace my whole staff here." But he used a line I bet you've never heard before. He said, "I have no room in my budget." You never heard that before, right?
Oh, no, no, never. Never heard that.
First time.
No room in my budget.
Exactly. The first time you ever heard that, right?
In fact, XM Radio just told me that very thing. We'd love to run you, Philip, but we have no room in our budget right now.
Yeah, I have XM Radio, as a matter of fact. They do a great job with Major League Baseball, but that's another topic for another time.
I thought they were going to run these two little shows we do, and maybe some programming for the blind, and they still might, and we're dealing with them. But so far, they have categorically said, "We don't care about you, 9 million. And I said, 9 million blind people. Anyway, go ahead with your story.
Well, they've got 4 million subscribers, but that's
another
story.
They do. Anyway.
But anyhow... he had no room in his budget. So I said to him...
Yeah, I'll work for nothing.
No, I tried that, too. That didn't work. But he said, "No, we can't do that." He said, "Somewhere we've got to find a salary." And I said, "Okay, suppose I can get VRS to agree to pay my salary for X amount of months."
Okay.
"That way, even if you don't have anything, then I can still walk out of WBZ and say, I've had X amount of experience at a 50,000-watt radio station." And he said to me, "You get him to go for it, you got a deal." So I argued back and forth with my VRS counselor, and they agreed to sponsor me. It took 6 months for this whole thing to start, but they agreed to sponsor me for at least 3 months. So we worked out a date, and in February, I'll never forget it, February the 8th of 1971, I came back to Boston. I met with the program director that morning, and he told me, he said, "For the first day or two, I just want you to hang around, you know, and meet people and talk to people and everything else." And I did it, and it was a lot of fun for me because WBZ Signal went into Rochester, and I had a ball. I mean, I met everybody that I heard on the air. And I was in a 50,000-watt radio station, and, man, I enjoyed every bit of it.
Now, were you walking through this building with a cane or a guide dog, or how were you?
Just a cane, no guide dog. No guide dog. But, you know, he would introduce me to different people. I spent a lot of time with the program director, and he introduced me to the different personalities. And then the second day that I was there, he called me in, and he said, "I want you to go back to the hotel, get a good night's sleep." He said, "Tomorrow night I want you to come in here and work with a character named Larry Glick." Now, Larry Glick is a guy who is from the Boston area. He used to be on the air from midnight to 5 o'clock in the morning. And Larry was the kind of a guy, he had a program where he would call anybody. In other words, somebody would call him up and say, "Hey, Larry, I got a telephone number for such and such." And they'd give Larry the phone number off the air, and you'd hear Larry pick up the phone and actually make the phone call. Dial the phone would ring, the guy'd pick up the phone at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, and, "Hi, this is Larry Glick. We're on the air on WBZ Radio." Well, what happened was, he called somebody, I don't know where, in Iowa or someplace.
And they said,
"I'm going to sue this station if this happens one more time for invasion of privacy. Because you put me on the air without my permission."
Well, and you can't do that.
No, you can't do that.
You can't do that.
So that's when they decided that here's this kid that's fresh out of college and wants a job, so we'll have him work for this character, Glick. So that's what I used to do. I used to make the calls off the air or set up stuff ahead of time and get their permission to have them come on the air, and we were able to work out. And Larry liked it because he said, "Geez, you know, I never had a schedule before. We never knew that at 1 o'clock in the morning we were going to talk to so-and-so, or at 2 o'clock we were going to do this, or at 4 o'clock we were going to do such and such."
Okay, but now before you took this job, he was there by himself all night, or he had an engineer maybe doing...
He had an engineer just to keep him on the air, but the engineer didn't make the phone calls for him.
Yeah, because at that time they had to have a guy there doing transmitter readings.
Right.
They had to have a guy somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
They could read the transmitter.
So Larry's was the only show that did not have a producer. Every other show that was on the air at that time at WBZ did. So then, you know, they got me, and I became Larry Glick's producer, and that's how I got the job. And after the first 3 months of being at BZ, I had a meeting with the powers that be, and they said, you know, let's see if we can get them to go for another 3 months. So the VRS agreed to do another 3 months. So this brought us into...
You've been there 6 months now.
Yeah, and then they called me in before the end of the 6 months and said, look, unless you turn into a blithering idiot, we're going to hire you at the end of these 6 months. You know, your probationary period is over. We love you, and we're going to hire you. So August 1st of 1971, I officially went on WBZ Radio's payroll as a full Westinghouse employee.
But you're right. It is being in radio off times at the right place at the right time.
That's right. It all just worked out. I mean, if it hadn't have, if Dick Walsh hadn't have been my instructor in college, and if this guy Bill Schubert had not been the program director at WBZ at the time, I wouldn't have been able to have been there for 14 years and wouldn't have been able to do some of the things that we were able to.
I've told this little story before, but I'll shoot it by one more time. I worked at a station in town that I worked at three or four times. I would work there a while, and they decided they didn't like me. I've gotten fired from the station several times, and then we'd go about 6 months, and I'd work my way back in. I did everything there. I managed this station. I was program director. I was chief engineer. Well, the last time I got fired was 1984. And I was standing there with my Braille clock in my hand waiting for my wife to come and pick me up. A car pulled up. A guy got out named Randy Shannon that I knew that worked across town. And he said, hi, Phil, are there any openings here? And I said, well, there weren't until 15 minutes ago. But there are now. And he went in and got my job. So right place at right time.
Exactly.
You know? And that's where you were.
That's where I was.
But you had not worked on the air as a disc jockey up until then. You'd not been a sportsman. You'd not run the board.
I knew how to. I mean, the board at BZ was very easy. It was only, you know, six pots, couple of microphones, two turntables, and three or four cart machines. But I learned how to run it because the first time I ever got a chance to go on the air, a fellow named Glick overslept and didn't show up on time.
And it was
so
your turn.
I went on the air for about an hour and a half until he got there. I was never so scared in my entire life. But I loved it. I just loved every minute of it. And then in August of 1971, they needed somebody to do, at that time we did a program called Calling All Sports, which was on Saturday nights from 8 to midnight. And they needed somebody to do it because all the sports talk show hosts were out of town. So the station called me. Oh, boy, they called me at 10:30 on a Thursday morning. It felt like the middle of the night because I'd worked all night.
You've been up with Larry Glick all night.
I've been up with Larry Glick all night, and they called me up and said, listen, can you do Calling All Sports on Saturday night?
And you went, yes, I can, please.
I said, you mean produce it? And they said, no, host it. And I said, me? And they said, yeah. And I said, are you sure? And they said, yep. And I said, absolutely. So I got there, like at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
I bet you did.
I did. I sat down with the producer, and we wrote out the major league schedules and all the afternoon scores and all that kind of thing. And we went over all kinds of wire copy about stuff. And then about 6:30, I started walking up and down the halls and thinking to myself, man, if I blow this, I'm dead. I'm out of here. Why did I ever agree to do this? I got to sit in front of a mic for 4 hours on a radio station that hits 38 states in Canada. I must be crazy. But you know what? I did it. I did it, and I got through it. And one of the first people that we had on the air that kind of eased the way through was a gentleman named Gil Santos, who was, and people here on the East Coast will know his name, he was and still is the radio voice of the New England Patriots football team. And I understand that afterwards he called our program director and said to him, you know what, that kid is born to be on the air.
That's
and,
right. That's great.
I'll always be grateful to him for that.
Now, while you were apprehensive and while you were nervous and everything else that you could possibly be, you were also thrilled.
Oh, absolutely. Are you kidding?
No.
I mean, when I was in college, BZ Radio was the station to listen to. Everybody listened to BZ Radio. And even after I got out of college, the whole talk around Boston was WBZ because it was 50,000 watts. And they had some of the great talents around Boston. Some of the best people in the business were there. And to have listened to it and listened to it up in Rochester when I was home, and when I knew I had the possibility of working there, I would listen to it every night, every chance I got. And here I am finally in this at this station, and all my heroes are there that I listened to when I was in college.
Yeah.
And now I'm on the air just like they are.
It is.
I was absolutely thrilled.
That there's just nothing that could have happened to you that could have been, my dream when I was a kid was to work at WJJD in Chicago, which was the 1160, the 50,000 watt daytime country, because I'm a country music guy. I would have given my left, you know what, to have done afternoons there. I never got there, and I did all right. I made a living in radio, but I never worked at it. Because at that time, you folks don't understand that, because you're all younger than we are. At that time, the AM band was much different than it is now. It was, many of the stations that were on were what we called daytimers. So they signed off at sundown. And there was nothing else for many, many, many years, 50 years of radio, there was nothing else on 1030 kilohertz or kilocycles at that time at night except WBZ in Boston. They were the only radio station on 1030.
And a lot of other Clear Channel radio stations, it was the same. So when all these other daytimers would sign off, these signals would go, as they say, gangbusters all over. And that's why a station like WHAM or WBZ or KMOX in St. Louis or WLS in Chicago, you could hear them all the time. I mean, I remember listening to these stations. And that was a neat thing because they're all different.
Yeah.
You know, now it's all basically the same thing. You go up and down the dial, it's how many radio stations have Art Bell or how many are carrying Rush Limbaugh in the daytime or even sometimes at night. It's much different now, and I don't mean to sound prejudiced, but it's not as good as it was when we were younger.
I don't think so, because there's no DXing on. I mean, you know, in Texas, it was because you'd listen to the big. We have a 50,000 watt daytimer in license to Corpus Christi, Texas, and they would sign that sucker off, and so you would aim your loop to see if when that carrier dropped out, then if you could hear WBZ.
Mm-hmm.
And but no more. Now if you do that same thing, you get hundreds of radio stations. I don't know how many there are, but 1030 is just a very crowded frequency at night. There's no chance for me to hear WBZ in Boston.
The only way you can do it now is on a computer.
The only way you can do it now is on a computer. Well, I think the rule now is if you are more than 500 miles from the... And I hate to use this word. You'll know when I use it. You'll know why. From the Clear Channel, and I don't mean any. I don't mean Clear Channel Radio like we know now that owns 1,200 radio stations. I mean the station that was that channel was their Clear Channel. If you're more than 500 miles, you have to do night. I think that's the law now. And so there's lots of the frequencies. There's lots of stations on AM is just a screwed up mess now. I mean, that's all you can say about it.
Well, when I think back of the opportunities that we had and the things that I was able to do, I'm very grateful for the chance to have had it. It was a wonderful opportunity. I'll treasure the memories. Nobody will ever take it away. You know, I keep saying that, but. I had a chance to fill in for Larry Glick for 3 weeks in 1972.
Yeah, let me do this. Can I take just a little short break, and I want to talk a few minutes about that, okay?
You do whatever you want.
Well, I sure will, Kenny, and thank you, sir, and we'll be back in just a minute with more of our little show called Blind Like Me. Hang on. Blind Like Me list.
And I have made a lot of new friends on the Blind Like Me list that I'll never forget.
Well, them crazy people on that Blind Like Me list just talk about the silliest thing.
To join the Blind Like Me list, send a blank email to blindlikeme-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. That's blindlikeme-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
Okay, I love being on the Blind Like Me list because I'm the moderator. And I get to delete people if I want to.
If you enjoy chatting with other blind folks, come join us on the Blind Like Me list. Send a blank email to blindlikeme-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
our guest on Blind Like Me, and we're proud to have him. He's a radio man like many of you are. I meet so many blind people who are just fell in, like you and I did, in love with radio. But you had the best experience I've ever heard of any person, that blind person who was interested in radio, and in that your first job, first radio job out of school, was at 50,000 watt WBZ in Boston.
That's right. Not Wonderful. Everybody is that lucky. Most people have to start in a small market and work their way up. It's just like a ball player traveling up to the major leagues. Most of the time, they don't start up at the top. They have to start in the minors and work their way up.
And oftentimes, we never get past the, you know, I got as far as Houston. I worked at a radio station in Houston, which is a major market. Mm-hmm. But then I'd worked there long enough, and I moved to a small town, and I figured I'd be a big fish in a little pond. Anyway, well, that's another story. But
I will tell you a story that will make you very envious and very jealous.
Good.
I got a chance to fill in for Larry Glick in 1972 for 3 weeks.
Uh-huh.
One of the people that I did an interview with was Kurt Gowdy.
Really?
He came into the station. I was friendly with Kurt's producer at the time. And we set up an interview in the daytime. Kurt came in and we taped the interview. When it was finished, and luckily he said it right on the interview, he said, "That's the best interview I've ever had by anybody."
Wonderful.
So we aired the interview. My program director called me on the air and complimented me on the interview, said he never heard anything like it. Now, a few weeks after that, Gowdy was filling in on our Calling All Sports broadcast, and I just happened to be in the neighborhood because I had a print copy of Kurt's autobiography, and I wanted him to autograph it.
Uh-huh.
So when I walked into our general manager's office, he casually said to me, "Kenny, what are you doing tonight?" And I said, "Oh, nothing much. Why?" And he said, "Well, Kurt can't do the last half hour of the program, and we were wondering, as long as you were here, if you wouldn't mind filling in." And I said, "You want me to fill in for Kurt Gowdy?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, I think I'm available.
Yeah,
boy,
I
have fun announcing on the air who I was, and I was filling in for Kurt Gowdy, who at that time was the voice of NBC Sports.
That's pretty amazing little story. It really is. Do you have any cassettes, any tapes?
I don't have as much as I'd like to have, but I do have some. Yes. Again, I don't have that one. At least I don't think I do. If I do, it's buried somewhere in the basement in a box because I moved out here a year ago and haven't really unpacked anything.
And you haven't gotten a chance to transfer any of it to CD yet?
No. I do have a lot of stuff on cassette, but I don't have the show that I did with Gowdy. And that show I wish I had, because I had a chance to interview Ted Williams.
Really?
And I played that interview that night filling in for Gowdy. So I had a lot of great thrills in my life at BZ.
Do you have any of the 3 week period of time when you sat in for Larry Glick? Do you have any of that?
I have some of the interviews. I interviewed Mike Douglas. He was in town. I interviewed Joe Garagiola.
Really?
Some of these people were really easy to get. I thought I'd have to go through a bunch of people to get to Garagiola, but I remember I called NBC and I asked for his office, and he answered the phone, and I was so surprised. You know, he picked it up and he said, "Hello," and I said, "Joe?" He said, "Yeah." And I said, "You answer your own phone?"
He said, well, the girl's down the hall.
I was sitting here and it rang, and I just figured the best thing to do was answer it.
Good answer.
So,
Good.
It was better than anything I could have come up with. So it was, you know, it was a lot of fun. BZ Radio worked in conjunction with WBZ Television. They were both in the same building. And I got a chance to meet and greet people I never in my life thought I would meet. In 1971, WBZ Radio celebrated their 50th anniversary on the air. And we did a whole week of old-time radio personalities from 8 to midnight. When one of the people that we got was Art Linkletter.
Really?
Did, of course, People Are Funny and Art Linkletter's House Party.
Had he worked there at one time years ago?
No, he did not. But Vaughn Monroe did, and we got him.
Vaughn Monroe
was a staff announcer at WBZ in 1933.
Did WBZ carry Art Linkletter's House Party at one time?
They did, because they were an NBC affiliate at one time. They were an NBC affiliate till 1957, and then they divested themselves and became independent and strictly were working with Westinghouse correspondents and broadcasters. But the point of the story is that we got him on the air in 1971.
Yeah.
In 1972, for whatever reason, he was in the building over at BZ Television.
Really?
And I found out about this, so I clomped over to BZ TV, and I introduced myself, and I said, I don't know whether you remember, but, you know, we had you on the air in September of 71, and I said to him, have you got 10 or 15 minutes to come over and do an interview with me? And he said, look it, if we haven't got the time, we'll make time.
Really?
So he just got up and walked out of the television studio. And somebody told me later on they saw Linkletter and I walking down the hall, and they didn't know who had the biggest grin on their face. Linkletter because he made me happy, or me because I was happy meeting our Linkletter.
And so this, but this was after the anniversary. This was after the anniversary.
I got him into a news booth. We taped about 10 or 15 minutes, and I eventually was able to put it on the air.
That's amazing. Do you have that?
I think so, somewhere.
Man.
You've got to remember, this is 30-some years ago.
I know. We had cassettes then. You know?
Yeah, I know we did. I know we did. We had reel-to-reel. I do have some... One of the things that I have part of is an interview that I did with Dennis Day and Don Wilson from the Jack Benny program.
Well, that would be great. That would... Oh, man, that would be classic.
They came to Boston in 1980 in a Broadway production called The Big Broadcast of 1944. So I had them in the studio. I don't have the original reel-to-reel, but when I was at another station in town at the time, which was the CBS affiliate, we took part of that interview and aired it, and I found that about a week ago. So I do have some of that. And listening to that now, knowing that these guys were legends in broadcasting,
yeah,
is fantastic.
Now, so WBZ came on in 1921.
Right, September of 1921.
So they weren't far behind KDKA, were they?
No, they were not.
They had to be one of the first 10 stations in the nation to come on.
Yeah, and their television station, WBZ-TV, was the first one in Boston. They went on the air in 1948, and they were the first TV station in town at the time. So there's a lot of rich history involved with BZ Radio and BZ.
Yeah, the commission figured back then, well, there'll never be so many radio stations. We'll need more than three call letters. We're just getting three call letters.
Yeah, that was rather interesting.
There won't be that. There'll never be that many.
And they used to have great promos that would say, like, for example, hi, this is Larry Glick. I'll be Z-ing you right after the news. Or I'll be Z-ing you in 1 hour.
Be Z-ing you. Oh, that's great. Wasn't that great?
I wish they used that now.
Yeah, well, of course, now their Clear Channel probably owns them now.
No, they're owned by Infinity Broadcasting, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, so they don't run Rush Limbaugh, or
no,
do they?
No, they don't. Another station in town does. They do not. BZ does not have syndicated programming. They're one of the. I think they're the only local station in town that on AM that has live talk during the night. Nobody else does.
That's still actually doing a show in and unto itself that isn't Art Bell.
Right, right. In fact, there's a story about that. We had a guy here on WBZ named David Brudnoy, who passed away a year ago. He had all kinds of complications. He had AIDS for a while and eventually died of cancer. But people on the East Coast will remember his name. Now, for whatever reason, WBZ decided to drop David Brudnoy and run Tom Snyder, former host of The Tomorrow Show. But he had a radio program at the time.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, well, BZ Radio ran it for a while. But the ratings were so bad, people wanted Brudnoy back. Some guy got a campaign started to get Brudnoy back on the air, and that's exactly what happened. They dumped
Tom Snyder.
And rehired Brudnoy to go back on the air, so it didn't say much for network talk at the time. But radio stations do it now because it's they don't have to pay a talent. It's a cheap way out. All they have to do is pay somebody to run a board and play local spots whenever they have them scheduled.
They don't have to do that. The computer will do that for you.
Yeah, well, they do that too, I guess. So it's too bad that night radio has become that way.
Well, radio period has become that way. We, of course, we live, our town is about 40,000 people. Our big country station, the 100,000-watt full C radio station here is live in the day, but at night the disc jockey's in Austin.
And he's
voice tracking from there down to Lufkin, Texas. And, of course, all night long, Clear Channel has their own little country shows. Clear Channel owns five stations here in our market, and that's what you get. But we now have XM Satellite, and that I think, is the way of the future. I think so, too.
It's commercial free radio. I enjoy it. They have an old-time radio channel. I love their music channels.
They do, yeah.
I enjoy their baseball coverage. And the only thing that I don't like is, at least this year, you only get the home announcers. I've heard, and I don't know how reliable this is, that next year you'll be able to have both choices. So, in other words, if you're a fan of the Yankees and you want to hear John Sterling when the Yankees are on the road, next year you'll be able to do it.
Well, yeah, it was Saturday night, Houston. I can't remember who they played Saturday night. Maybe Washington.
New
Washington team Saturday night. So we listened to it, but Cook Burgers and all of us, are about 20 of us, swimming in the pool and listening to the ball game. But we had to listen to the Washington announcers.
And one of them is a friend of mine, as a matter of fact, Dave Shea, who does color and does alternate play-by-play with Charlie Slows. I used to work with him at WEEI here in Boston.
Of course, we wanted to hear Milo Hamilton, who is our guy, our local announcer.
He does a good job, as a matter of fact.
He does.
I interviewed him once when he was in Atlanta after Hank Aaron hit number 715. And he's a good announcer. He's excellent.
I just wonder, is there any chance of getting together enough interviews or enough old radio that you did to do an hour show 6 months from now? Is there any chance of that?
Oh, boy.
Of getting together and maybe you putting it on a CD and sending me the CD, and we could do you, and then I could play little bits, and, you know, let's talk about that. We don't have
We can talk about it, all right. I don't know.
Do you have, we're out of time, we've killed an hour, and do you have an email address that you'd be willing to give in case anyone would want to contact you?
Sure. Very, very easy one. It's Ken@BostonPete.com. Ken@BostonPete.com.
Ken@BostonPete.com.
Right.
And just very quickly, you're not doing radio now. You have a government job now.
Yeah, I have a government job. I work for the city of Boston.
Do you know Tim Cummings and Cheryl Cummings?
Somewhat, yes. I know who they are from Playback Magazine. I've talked to Cheryl a couple of times, and I have met Tim a long time ago, but I don't know them very well.